knew they were going to win it, man.
As soon as Davies come on, we knew.
We won. We knew it. We were going to win that.
We won.
Canada will play another day. The men's soccer team defeats South Africa in a nail-biting match at the FIFA World Cup. This is Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skanderas. Also on the program, missiles and drones exchange between the U.S. and Iran. But Washington insists peace talks are still on. Plus, pulled from the rubble, rescuers in Venezuela save a 9-month-old baby and his mother as the desperate search continues for more survivors from last week's earthquakes. Before 2026, Canada's record at the FIFA World Cup was characterized by loss. Well, not only has that changed, Canada's men's national soccer team has advanced further than ever, now into the round of 16. Canada has defeated South Africa 1-0. Caroline Bargoot was watching it all for us. Caroline, what a game. Tell us how it all went down.
Oh, my. You know, both teams fought so hard for this game. South Africa dominated the first half. 6 minutes in, they took their first shot, but goalkeeper Maxime Crepo made the save. Then Jonathan David got a free shot, but he couldn't get it in the net. The score still 0-0 by the first hydration break. And Canada had a few chances after that, but still couldn't score. In the second half, Canada got two yellow cards. Then the momentum shifted 74 minutes into the match when Alfonso Davies was subbed in. Now, he tore his hamstring last year. He hasn't played since. His presence really seemed to energize his team. 91 minutes into the game, and Canada finally scores. Stefan Eustachio gets it in the net. The crowd goes wild. Canadian fans in LA couldn't contain their excitement.
I am feeling really freaking ecstatic right now. It's just so exciting. I'm so happy. I've lost my voice. I can't even put anything into words, which my wife is not going to believe.
We're feeling great. We're going to run. Davies is back. Eustachio's rolling. We're going to do it. Let's go, Canada!
Canada was expected to win that match. It was sitting at number 32 in the FIFA men's rankings, while South Africa was at 54.
So who is Canada up against next?
Very good question. We don't actually know. So for the first time ever, Canada's going to head into the round of 16. They're either going to face Morocco or the Netherlands on Saturday. Now, those teams face off tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern in Monterrey, Mexico. Whoever wins is going to pose a major challenge for Team Canada. That's because according to the FIFA men's rankings, Morocco is sixth, the Netherlands is seventh. And after Sunday's match, Canada now sits at 30.
Morocco, the team that eliminated Canada from the last World Cup back in 2022. So that'll be good. A good match coming up either way. Caroline, thank you so much.
Thanks.
CBC's Caroline Bargoot in Vancouver. So Canada's men's soccer team had three overall goals for this World Cup. Earn its first point, win a match, advance past the group stage. Now that those objectives have been met, Canada is in uncharted territory. Philip Lee Shenock looks back at how far the team has come.
At a watch party in Toronto, the crowd goes wild. Only one goal in the match between Canada and South Africa, but that's all it took to make history. Fans broke out into the national anthem to celebrate Canada advancing into the round of 16. These fans on the University of Toronto campus say there's no stopping them now.
Always knew they were going to win it, man. Always knew it.
We're going to win the World Cup.
We're going to win the World Cup, brother. We're going to win it.
As soon as Davies come on, we knew.
We won. We knew it. We were going to win that.
We knew it.
But the seniors' men's team has come a long way from its first appearance in a World Cup in 1986.
We played France in that first game, and they, like this time around, were considered one of the favorites to win the World Cup.
Bob Leonarduzzi was there. He was a member of Canada's men's national soccer team, which lost all their games in Mexico, falling to France 1-0, Hungary 2-0, and the Soviet Union 2-0.
It's 40 years later, and I don't think we really had the attention of the whole country. I think this time around, we definitely do.
That first appearance was followed by a long drought. It would be 36 years before they qualify again, but they did come close. Ian Hume played for the national team for 14 years, when the team made the semifinals in 2007 and went on to qualifying rounds in 2011 and 2012.
We always played to win, and we thought we could win every game. Did it happen? No.
In 2022, Hume was one of the 9 former players on the honor guard to support the team at their second World Cup appearance.
4 years ago was kind of the pinnacle, with getting actually qualifying for Qatar was huge. But having it on our soil is something special.
As co-hosts, Canada gained automatic qualification, but the hard-fought 1-1 draw against Bosnia and Toronto earned Canada's men's side its first ever point in a senior World Cup. A 6-0 win over Qatar and a loss to Switzerland put them through the group stage to the knockout round. Canada was ranked 120th in the world in 2017. Now they're in the top third. Murray Millard is the author of Winning Pitch, the Canada men's soccer team at the World Cup and beyond.
Hey, the women have been doing it for a number of years now. It's really the men that have more recently elevated.
Jesse Marsh, who took over as head coach in May 2024, says there was a solid foundation to build on.
The success John Herdman had and the success we're having in this moment, like, this has been a big mission for the country to continue to build the sport, and we know we're at a moment as well.
Now they've gone further than any other Canadian men's team. They've survived the group stage, securing a place in the last 16 teams, and there's no looking back. Philip Shaddock, CBC News, Toronto.
Still ahead, setting up a more complicated Canada Day in Alberta, where people who are part of the separatist movement say they'll be waving the provincial flag instead of the maple leaf. That story's ahead on Your World Tonight. Tens of thousands of people remain missing in Venezuela after twin earthquakes caused mass devastation on Wednesday. Search and rescue crews continue with their work, even as the chance of finding survivors diminishes by the hour. Meanwhile, people are growing increasingly frustrated with their government's response. Katie Simpson reports from the Colombian border with Venezuela.
Lay him back.
4 days in, and still, there are new reasons to hold onto hope in Venezuela. A father and son are pulled out alive from the rubble of a building in La Guaira by an American disaster response team.
Just want to take a quick look.
At least 33 people have been rescued this weekend, according to government officials. These operations remain the priority as foreign aid floods into Venezuela, which has struggled to mount an emergency response. More than 2,700 search and rescue workers have been flown in. At least 24 countries have sent some form of aid, including 521 tons of supplies. The scope of the disaster is only starting to come into focus, since communication systems in the hardest hit areas remain unreliable. Jorge Rodriguez, Venezuela's National Assembly president, says there are 774 collapsed buildings. Shoddy infrastructure is likely a factor in the widespread destruction, the byproduct of years of corruption and mismanagement during the Nicolas Maduro regime. While he is no longer president and awaits trial in the U.S., some Venezuelans say the current government has failed to meet this moment of crisis.
La respuesta ha sido nula. Se demuestra que no tienen nada.
The response has been null. It has shown they have nothing, says Wilson Oraste. He is an engineer, but there's no work for him in Venezuela, so he crosses into neighboring Colombia by foot to make a few dollars turning in plastic recycling. As a country, we are going to get out of this, he says, by the hand of God and with international help. But that help has not reached everyone who needs it.
Saber que unos vecinos están allí.
It has been a very difficult situation because one feels helpless, says Diogenes Misuti. He lived in an apartment near the coast that doubled as a popular vacation rental spot. Misuti survived because he wasn't home when his building collapsed, but many of his neighbors and visitors were inside.
Dos hijos y dos sobrinos.
Misuti gets choked up as he remembers a man on vacation with his 4 children. All are now dead.
Y los rescatistas tratar de, bueno, de por lo menos darle sepultura.
Through tears, he says, he hopes everyone can get a proper burial. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Cúcuta, Colombia.
Iran and the U.S. have traded fresh attacks, the already shaky ceasefire being tested yet again. American strikes landed deep inside Iran, while Iran claims it was able to strike U.S. military assets in the region. Peter Armstrong reports from Washington.
As a general rule, this is not what a ceasefire sounds like. And yet, instead of talks and negotiations, it's been a busy weekend of missiles and drones. On the streets of Tehran, this man said he doesn't trust that the U.S. will abide by the agreement. They've been attacking us for the past two nights, he says. In my view, Iran should strike Israel and deal with the U.S. That distrust runs both ways. Republican Senator Tom Tillis told CNN why he thinks the ceasefire is coming apart.
At a fundamental level, I just simply don't trust the Iranian leadership, the mullahs, to live up to their commitment.
Bridging that gap is no easy task, and the leadership of both countries is turning up the heat. On social media this weekend, President Donald Trump said there may come a point when, quote, we are no longer reasonable. If that happens, the Islamic Republic of Iran will no longer exist, he said. A spokesperson for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard said the U.S. is, quote, deceptive, untrustworthy, and prone to breaking its agreements. If the enemy violates the ceasefire, he says, our response will be stronger than before. It's been 10 days now since the two sides agreed to a 60-day ceasefire. The intent was to stop the fighting so a broader agreement could be reached.
The president's patience isn't going to last forever.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Mike Waltz. He told Fox News that negotiations are ongoing, but
they need to understand their leverage is diminishing by the day.
But one key point of leverage remains. All those ships stuck in the Persian Gulf remain on the wrong side of the Strait of Hormuz. Former Biden official Jake Sullivan says even a shaky ceasefire is better than the alternative.
I think both sides have enough incentive to keep it going that you'll just see this continue 60 days, then another 60 days, then another 60 days. And that's kind of the new normal we're living in.
Tonight, we're getting word that both sides have agreed to halt their attacks and resume talks. But this weekend has shown yet again that the first and still the biggest struggle is just keeping the ceasefire in a place that it possibly can be extended. Peter Armstrong, CBC News, Washington.
Parts of Western Europe are starting to cool down after days of intense heat. But in Central and Eastern Europe, the mercury is hitting all-time highs. Poland may have recorded its highest ever temperature, 40.5 degrees, in a town on the border with Germany. Parts of Czechia and Lithuania are also smashing records. The World Health Organization says there have been at least 1,300 heat-related deaths since June 21st. Many of those are in France, where officials have reported around 1,000 excess deaths during the height of its heat wave. Earlier this month, the U.S. announced new tariffs on dozens of countries because of concerns they weren't doing enough to fight forced labor. Canada was one of them. Now, a group of Canadian lawyers says Ottawa needs to look more closely at goods coming over the U.S. border and forced labor there. Salma Ibrahim has more.
It's basically modern-day slavery.
Human rights lawyer James Yap is trying to stop goods made by Alabama prison workers from getting into Canada. He says the state's work release program qualifies as forced labor under Canadian law.
They're required to work. They can be punished for refusing to work or even for being fired from their work.
Workers who refuse to work can face disciplinary measures, including like loss of good time credits.
Meredith Stewart is with Jobs to Move America.
They get transferred out of the safer work release facilities to the higher security prisons with more extreme violence and threats of solitary confinement.
The U.S. advocacy group launched their own lawsuit against the Alabama Prison Labor Program.
There's also been allegations that if they refuse to work, they can get denied parole. All of those conditions amount to coercion that essentially push people into work release jobs and force them to remain there.
Alabama officials say inmates benefit from the work release program. They argue it's voluntary and helps prepare for life after they've served their sentences. But Yap and his group, Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights, disagree.
What we hope to do is to put some pressure on that system.
They filed a complaint to Canada's Competition Bureau, naming four companies they allege import goods made in part by Alabama prison laborers. And they're using the company's legally required modern slavery reports to do it.
So by making these statements that there is no forced labor in their business operations or supply chains, when in fact they're linked to forced prison labor in Alabama, that is a violation of competition law.
The law that mandates the modern slavery reporting came into effect in 2024. It forces large companies to show how they're keeping forced labor out of their supply chains. But Yap says there's no real follow-up.
The Canadian government should be doing more.
Public Safety Canada says those reports are a transparency tool, not meant to penalize companies for identifying risks in their supply chains. But Yap says Canada's customs ban on forced labor and prison labor is rarely enforced. So
the Competition Bureau mechanism allows some measure of accountability for the truth.
The federal government introduced a new bill last week it says will tighten up enforcement.
We have identified that there are gaps in our regime.
That's Parliamentary Secretary Rob Oliphant. He announced the bill. It will allow the Minister of Foreign Affairs to create a list of goods and regions at risk of forced labor. Canada's Border Security says that will help. And the companies named in the complaint say they're all committed to keeping forced labor out of their supply chains. Salma Ibrahim, CBC News, Ottawa.
A fast-growing wildfire is moving closer to the northern Manitoba community of Lynn Lake. The province's wildfire service says it has now burned about 5,100 hectares, a massive jump from 1,600 hectares on Saturday afternoon. Mayor Brandon Dulwich says the town doesn't have enough resources to fight the fire.
There's limited crews, limited resources. I fully believe that we would have adequate resources and crews to fight fires going into this season, but that is not appearing to be the case.
Lynn Lake is under a mandatory evacuation order with the final flight out leaving today. All roads into the town have been closed. Officials say firefighters are facing challenging conditions with warm temperatures, low humidity, and shifting winds. Three firefighters have died and two others injured while battling a wildfire on the Utah-Colorado border. The U.S. Wildland Fire Agency said they were part of an interagency response, but is not saying how they died. Hot, dry, windy weather has fanned wildfires across much of Utah, Arizona, and other western states. A lake beside a melting glacier northeast of Pemberton, BC, could burst at any time. So two dozen properties in the path of that water are under evacuation orders because of the risk of flooding. But as Alana Kelly is finding out, some homeowners aren't leaving.
I'm going to do everything I can to protect my home as long as I can.
Don Coggins is on evacuation order due to the immediate danger of a glacial lake bursting, but he isn't leaving.
This is our home. We bought out here 10 years ago, and this was where we planned to retire. And I'm not about to give it up.
The glacial lake outburst can happen any minute now. Rocks, trees, and water will come flowing towards his property northeast of Pemberton. The regional district strengthened an embankment that will send all the water towards Pool Creek and divert it from Gates Lake.
That barrier holds, and more water comes this way, there will be more damage.
The water at the lake is already larger than last year's outburst. Experts say it's difficult to predict when the burst will happen. Alana Kelly, CBC News, Squamish.
This Canada Day, some Albertans will have mixed feelings about celebrations. As debate about Alberta's separatism increases in the province, some people say they'll be celebrating Albertan pride. Others are pushing back. Stephanie Cram brings us that story.
On a wet Edmonton day, a handful of protesters have come out to brave the rain, standing on an overpass with their Alberta flags flapping in the wind, getting a few honks in support of their cause. What they want is for Ottawa to hear their concerns. Tyson Rahovich organized the event. He says this Canada Day will look a bit different.
We've all been, proud supporters of Canada and the Canadian values, right? Celebrating Canada every year.
The only difference that, like I said, we're standing against the government. We are standing up for Alberta.
Theo Snegovsky, a political science professor at the University of Alberta, says Canada Day has always had protests.
Many parts of this country may well still celebrate Canada Day in that exact way as a protest. But I think in Alberta, it holds a different significance because you have this conversation about the future of Alberta within the country.
In recent years, the day has come with controversy.
We will reclaim every single thing that was taken.
In 2021, after potential unmarked graves were found at the Kamloops Residential School, people from coast to coast marked the day as a Cancel Canada Day, wearing orange instead of red and white.
I don't think there's anything to celebrate in genocide.
A few years later, protesters embraced the flag but protested COVID restrictions.
Freedom! Freedom!
It used to be the case that the left of the political spectrum would be more likely to protest Canada Day than the right, and the right would be more likely to display their patriotism. And now it seems like, at least in Alberta, that dynamic has flipped.
On the other side of the debate, Thomas Lukaszek from the Forever Canadian Group is pushing for Alberta to stay in Canada.
We are starting to reaffirm our love for Canada, so the pinnacle will be Canada Day for sure, but if you show up in Alberta right now, like nowhere else in Canada, there are Canadian flags everywhere already.
Snegovsky says it's important to keep in mind that when it comes to patriotism, it's complicated.
And just because someone has a symbol of something on their lawn, has a lawn sign, is waving a flag, you know, it doesn't mean they're a good or a bad person. People are really complicated.
Stephanie Cram, CBC News, Edmonton.
Quebec's main political parties are saying non to an English language debate before the fall election. The leaders haven't faced off in English since 2018, which was a historic first for the province. Alexander Silberman looks at what this decision could mean for the race.
Angry.
In Montreal's Côte des Neiges neighborhood, home to a large English-speaking population, many residents like Mira Anajar are disappointed by the absence of an election debate held in their primary language.
It's wrong. It's making people very bitter.
For Norma Friedman, it's also upsetting. She worries she won't have the information she needs before voting.
I can't really follow the conversation in French. It would be very difficult. It would be very frustrating for me. So I'm not even going to listen to it.
Quebec will not hold an English language debate before the fall election after the two main parties declined an invitation from a group of media organizations. The Conservative Party of Quebec and Quebec Solidaire accepted, but the CAQ and Parti Québécois declined. The Quebec Liberal Party also opted out, saying it would only join if all five leaders participated.
It's not a tradition in Quebec to have an English debate.
Daniel Bélan is director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. He says the decision not to debate in English is no surprise.
It's out of political calculus.
In 2018, former Premier François Legault and the other leaders participated in a televised English language debate, the first in Quebec's history. But the move was politically unpopular amongst nationalist francophones, and party leaders faced pushback. Bélan says they see nothing to gain from another debate and only risk.
It could infuriate a significant faction within their partisan base.
The absence of a debate is deeply disappointing for Quebec Anglophones, with many voters hoping topics like Bill 96 would be discussed. The new legislation limits access to government services in English.
It was deeply disappointing.
Eva Ludwig is president of Talking Advocating Living in Quebec, an advocacy group for the province's English-speaking community. She's urging the leaders to reconsider.
And when we're talking about important things where you need to hear the nuance, then it's important to hear it in your own language.
Quebec's leaders will face off in three French language debates, with polls showing a tightening three-way race. The separatist Parti Québécois is still leading, the Liberals are trailing, and the governing CAQ is gaining ground in third. With margins expected to be razor-thin in some ridings, English-speaking voters could make a difference at the ballot box. Alexander Silberman, CBC News, Montreal.
This is Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. You can hear Your World Tonight wherever you are. Just subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app or stream us live on the CBC News app. Just tap on the local icon. Toronto hosted its Pride Parade today. Prime Minister Mark Carney was among the marchers. The Prime Minister was welcomed with cheers from crowds. This was Toronto's 45th annual Pride event, billing itself as the second largest celebration of the 2S LGBTQ plus community in the world. Organizers named this year's theme, We Won't Stop, after overcoming funding shortfalls. They say it's because corporate sponsors have been pulling support for reasons they say could be tariffs or pushback against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. A swarm has descended on Rome. The Vespa, Italian for wasp, has turned 80 years old. And lovers of the iconic scooter have formed their own little colony in the city to celebrate. Megan Williams now on how the Vespa has become a symbol of freedom, friendship, and Italian style.
He's the first model, Primo Tipo, 46.
Wow.
The first design.
Down a flight of stairs below a scooter rental shop near the Colosseum lies a basement shrine to Italy's most iconic two-wheel form of transportation. In chronological order along the walls are parked sculptures in steel and chrome, otherwise known as Vespas. There are old advertising posters, vintage riding gear, and photos of Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck riding through Rome in the 1953 classic film Roman Holiday. It symbolized freedom, says Claudio Serra, who's run this rental business and museum for 30 years and grew up sneaking rides on his aunt's Vespa.
Prima della Vespa costruivano la Piaggio, costruiva aerei, soprattutto la guerra.
Before the Vespa, Piaggio built warplanes, he says. In 1946, aircraft engineer Corradino Descagno designed something simpler. A step-through scooter that women in skirts could ride as easily as anyone else.
L'importanza della prima pubblicità è che ci stava una donna.
The first ad featured a woman, he says. Factory owner Enrico Piaggio named it the Wasp, La Vespa, for its narrow waist and buzzy engine. The thousands in Rome's intense summer heat show how durable its appeal is.
Representation, you know, of the female that we can all ride. It's not just the men.
Yeah. Says Shirley Russell from Brisbane. David Mamandai and Dawn Brooks Mamandai rode double on a post-war Vespa in the original war paint color.
Well, we love Vespas. We met riding Vespas in New Orleans 16 years ago.
We have 13 scooters, and today we brought over 1951 Allstate. Original, yes. Everything.
It's all original.
These days, Vespa's parent company, Piaggio, is having a harder time. Sales and profits both down sharply in recent years as markets in Europe and Asia have weakened. But here in Rome this weekend, you'd never know it. The Vespa symbolizes Italy, says this Italian. It's Rome. Megan Williams, CBC News, Rome.
A comedy legend, a master of satire, a man whose movies have been introduced like this.
From the twisted mind of Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is 100 years old today.
This is it!
Born on a kitchen table in a Brooklyn apartment, he told CBS the comedy bug bit right away.
People would look down at my crib. I was only a few months old, and they would laugh. And I said, that's it. That's it. That's what I want.
Comedic aspirations took a pause with the Second World War. Brooks was drafted into the U.S. Army. Proudly Jewish and often using Yiddish in his humor, he'd go on to mock Hitler and the Nazis relentlessly, in particular with his musical, The Producers.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Not much was off limits for the man who made the film History of the World Part 1.
The Lord Jehovah has given unto you these 15... Oi. 10! 10 commandments!
Films like Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein...
That's Frankenstein.
...endure with classic lines.
Could be worse.
How?
Could be raining.
If you thought Brooks was winding up his career, you'd be wrong. 2 months ago, he announced a new Spaceballs sequel.
And the title is Spaceballs, the new one.
So how to live as long as Mel Brooks? Here's some advice from one of his classic characters, the 2,000-year-old man.
Be a friend to yourself. Shake your hand and pat yourself on the back. Take care of every part of your body as if it were your own.
Wisdom to go well beyond age 100. You've been listening to Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Good night.